It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Department of Justice has launched a task force to combat elder abuse. We'll talk with an advocate for senior citizens about the problem and his hopes for the new effort.
First, a cyber attack on the credit reporting company Equifax compromised the personal data of over 143 million Americans last May. What's more, the company didn't discover the breach until the end of July.
The Equifax breach differs from some previous hacks because of the kinds of information that it could have found their way into the hands of criminals.
It's been reported that social security numbers, birth dates, addresses, and maybe even driver's license numbers might have been stolen.
Lisa Schiller joins us now. She's a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, looking at this breach, just how bad is this?
Well, you know, it's pretty big, actually. I mean, we've seen several data breaches in the last few years, affecting several million consumers. This one is estimated to have affected potentially about half of the population. So it is pretty big. There's three major credit reporting agencies, Equifax being one of them. So I think this, you know, we all kind of need to really pay attention to this one.
And when we're hearing social security numbers and birth dates, some addresses, and then maybe for some customers, credit information and driver's licenses, that's like all the stuff, right? I mean, a criminal could do a lot of work with those.
A criminal definitely could do a lot of work with some of that and with all of that. So, yes, it's definitely something to be, you know, very aware of. But, you know, also the Better Business Bureau wants consumers to stay calm. That's the first step. I mean, we don't want to, you know, get too excited and do anything rational or, affect your health in any way by becoming upset. But at the same time, you know, you want to be vigilant. Stay in touch with the website of Equifax. This is an evolving situation. Information is changing. So you want to be aware of what's going on, for your own needs.
I want to give a listen to Equifax CEO Rick Smith. He released a video yesterday apologizing for the security breach and offering at least some remedy. Here's a listen.
We're taking unprecedented step of offering every U.S. consumer in the country a comprehensive package of identity theft protection and credit file monitoring at no cost. We also opened a special call center and launched a dedicated website to provide consumers with information they need to manage their personal situation.
What do you think of the reaction you've seen so far from Equifax, Lisa?
Well, I think that, that's pretty typical in when there is a data breach. The company generally offers free credit monitoring and identity theft protection. However, consumers definitely need to be aware of the fine print involved in that. There are some frequently asked questions or FAQs on the company's website, on Equifax's website, that the Better Business Bureau wants consumers to read before signing up for any free credit monitoring or identity theft protection. So you can actually go to the company's website. I have done that. It's EquifaxSecurity2017.com. You can click on a button that says potential impact right on that screen, and you can actually put in your last name and the last six digits of your Social Security number, and it will inform you if they believe that you personally have potentially become a victim. Now, in my case, I have. I ran my husband's information as well, and he has also. So now we're just kind of sitting tight. We're very good at monitoring our credit card statements, our bank statements, but we're going to be extra careful right now. I'm not going to jump into any free credit monitoring or anything of that nature just yet. I want to make sure I go through all the frequently asked questions and I understand everything and get all of my questions answered before I sign up for anything.
What are the risks of the small print that you're worried about at this point?
Well, sometimes when you sign up for, different things such as free credit monitoring, you may be giving up your rights for anything else down the line. So, I guess in saying that, it's always good to read the fine print, like anything, but in this case as well.
We're talking to Lisa Schiller from Wisconsin's Better Business Bureau, looking at this big hack, this big data breach at Equifax, the social security numbers, credit information for some, affecting over 143 million Americans. So, Lisa, talk about good credit hygiene. What kind of things should we do to make sure that all of a sudden our credit cards aren't being used for the wrong thing? Our credit information isn't being used to do things that we don't want it to do?
Well, several things. First, the Better Business Bureau recommends limiting the number of third parties that you actually give your information to. And also, when shopping online, which, you know, we all do on a regular basis nowadays, make sure your payment, the payment web pages are encrypted. And when you get an email, do not click on any links inside that email that are unsolicited or maybe suspicious. And limit the websites that you use that actually allow you to keep your credit card information on file. One very important piece of information and we want to get across today is in light of this data breach, beware of scammers who may purport to be from the retailer or your bank or even your credit card issuer. Anyone telling you that your credit card was compromised or suggesting actions to fix the problem. Phishing emails may attempt to fool you right now into providing your credit card information, or they may ask you to click on a link or open an attachment, and doing so can download malware into your computer. So anytime we see anything big like this, we always see scams that follow in its wake.
That said, I get confused, Lisa, because I have had legitimate communications from credit card providers saying that there's something that they're worried about and you know, that it's the real deal. How do I tell the real ones from the scam ones?
Right. Well, generally, they will not come by email. Generally not. And also, if you see something and it's you're not sure, you know, if you should believe the email or the phone call or the, you know, even the letter in the mail, you know, go just pick up the phone and call the company directly to ask. Or in a case like Equifax, go directly to their website. So don't click on any links, but just go directly to their website.
And what is the right thing for people to do if, God forbid, they realize they have clicked on the wrong thing? They think they have been scammed, whether for this or some phone scam or something like this. What's the first step they should take if they're in that position?
Well, you know, as always, monitor all of your accounts. Report anything that is suspicious or doesn't look familiar to you at all. After any data breach, you might want to consider putting a credit freeze or a fraud alert on your credit reports with the three major credit reporting agencies. A credit freeze will prevent anyone from accessing your credit report or your scores, but it also means that you cannot apply for new credit without lifting that freeze. So that's something you can look into a little bit more in depth online as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier not wanting to overreact. I've seen people saying, hey, I went to that kind of creepy-looking Equifax website. It looks like my data was compromised. And people are saying, well, maybe I should freeze my credit right now just based on that. Is that an overreaction?
No. I mean, I think that a credit freeze is not overreacting. I think, you know, it's up to the individual. I think they should read about it and know exactly what is entailed in a credit freeze. But it's certainly something to consider and certainly nothing to be, you know, afraid of doing.
Do you hear of a lot of cases of identity theft and credit fraud here in Wisconsin, Lisa?
You know, we do hear of identity theft fairly often. Wisconsin isn't on the top of the list as far as identity theft, but it's been a big problem for many years. The Federal Trade Commission actually monitors the number of identity theft reports that are processed. And, you know, what we do here at the Better Business Bureau when we hear of identity theft or consumers report it to us is we refer them to the Federal Trade Commission. And they have a fantastic tool right on their website that you can follow through if you think that you've been a victim of identity theft.
What are you watching for now? As you mentioned, this is just coming out. Equifax has been changing somewhat in its reaction even just over today. What are you watching for next?
You know, unfortunately, data breaches are a part of our society nowadays. I mean, we've seen them happening through the years. We've seen some really big ones, you know, Target in January of 2014. We had Home Depot in 2014, as well as the Bank of New York Mellon, and Staples and Kmart. And, you know, I guess it's an unfortunate thing, but, you know, we just keep watching for, you know, when is the next one, unfortunately, and what can we do to get the word out and help people protect themselves and, you know, be vigilant and, you know, report something if they've been a victim.
And here in Wisconsin, what is a good first point of contact for people who want more information about any kinds of fraud that they may be encountering?
Well, we have a fantastic website, betterbusinessbureau.org/scamtracker. And you can actually go into our scam tracker tool and click on our heat map, and you can find out what scams are being reported where, and you can also report scams, whether or not you've been a victim. So consumers can always feel free to go to our website. If they have any questions about anything or you know, need any type of referral, they can always give us a call. Our public line is 1-800-273-1002.
We'll leave it there. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Lisa Schiller from the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau talking about the Equifax data breach. First, senior citizens are especially vulnerable to financial exploitation as well as physical and emotional abuse. It's a problem that experts say is growing and remains vastly underreported. Last week, Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel announced the creation of an elder abuse task force. Schimmel said the group will provide more resources for investigating and prosecuting abuse and work to improve communication between caretakers, law enforcement, and advocacy groups.
Nino Amato is the president and CEO of the Coalition for Wisconsin Aging Groups. Nino, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's nice to be back at Central Time.
Well, how common a problem is elder abuse in Wisconsin?
It's growing, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. A lot of it has to do with the demographics of having 10,000 baby boomers retire every single day since January 1 of 2011. And because of the inequality in the economy combined with people still struggling, even though there's an unemployment rate, the jobs that used to be there are no longer there. And so people are working much lower paid jobs. And what we're seeing is roughly around 35,000 cases of elder abuse, financial elder abuse, are reported each year. And that is really underreported because 60% of the financial elder abuse is committed by family members. Hmm. So they're reluctant to call the police. They're reluctant to get a state agency involved. And we get involved because we're a nonprofit. And then we encourage them and triage them down the process. But that has increased. Identity fraud has increased, and as we found out this morning with Equifax, 134 million credit ratings of individuals in this country has been robbed, breached, and that represents about 57% of the adults. So now you have two additional items that are going to surge, which were already surging. One is identity fraud. The other one is imposter fraud. And, you know, I kind of chuckle because I never thought I could get caught in some of these schemes. And 7 years ago, somebody obviously had spyware. They went into my calendar and realized I was going to have a vacation in Nuevo Vallarta. And lo and behold, the day that I got down there, where I turned off my cell phone, a blast went out to all my friends saying, oh, I got robbed. We need money.
Oh, no.
And so on and so forth. Well, it happens more commonly among elder people by impostering their grandchildren, niece, nephew, and even to the point, too, where they impostor state agencies. So if you recall back in the Affordable Care Act, one of the ways to close the gap on compensation for people who have a lot of prescription drugs they have to pay for, there was going to be a rebate. And the moment that was announced in the Affordable Care Act, these imposters get on the phone and say they're from, you know, the federal government, or we're from Medicare, Medicaid, we need your Social Security so you can get your check. And people were handing that over. So
right. So a lot going on with financial fraud, identity theft, imposters. What about other aspects, maybe physical abuse, emotional abuse, other things like that to be aware of?
It is. And tragically, as the nation is undergoing a lot of fragmentation politically, a lot of stress for, I can go on for a long time of what that may mean, both politically as well as psychologically. The fact of the matter is people's anxiety levels and stress levels are up. Well, that impacts families in general. On elder abuse, where we're finding some of the abuse is coming from family members who feel they're entitled to their money or their inheritance, and they're verbally abusing their spouse, or don't realize, or even if they do, that elderly have rights. So, for instance, when one of my siblings wanted to take my mother's car away, and she hadn't had an accident, you know, she was really pushing her to do that. And I said, no, she has a right to keep it. Now, we need to approach it differently and convince her differently, but she has that right. In cases that we've dealt with where there's money involved versus whether you should drive or not, it is vicious. It really is. And We don't have many cases. Usually if they're physical, they don't come to us. They actually go directly to law enforcement.
So you mentioned that elder abuse is widely underreported and how that can be because it's within the family and that makes it more difficult. Are there things that need to be done, do you think, to empower seniors and inform seniors about what their rights are, like you were saying, and what they can do and encourage them to report?
Well, that's the name of our program, Financial Empowerment. And we have been traveling the state since 2003. We're going to have a even greater activity coming up in the fall and into all of next year in all 72 counties. We work closely with the they call Aging Disability Resource Centers to really begin to bring people aware of how they can control their finances and what to expect, all the way down to people who may have a neighbor across the way and they're living by themselves and they are befriended by this, in this one case, an elderly gentleman. Who gradually would take control of their finances, then realizing that they're being robbed, but afraid to do anything. And, you know, the fact that we're available to merely assist provides people the avenue to interject. So in this one case, the woman was afraid because she lived right next door to this fellow, and she was not emotionally involved, but financially involved. And he kind of indirectly threatened her, and we were able to get her to come into our office with him. He thought they're coming to get some advice about financial management. We separated them in two separate rooms, and then we were able to resolve it. And he was reported to the police, and he was maybe not convicted, but he definitely has a record now. And so, you know, those are the type of things.
We're talking with Nino Amato right now, president and CEO of the Coalition for Wisconsin Aging Groups. And, Nino, Attorney General Brad Schimmel announced last week the creation of an elder abuse task force. It's still taking shape. What was your reaction to that news, and what are you hoping to see from it?
I think it's good. There was a number of programs in the past, and it's like everything else. An issue begins to surface, and people move very quickly, but we haven't had another refocus. So I think what the Attorney General is doing is a good thing. I know in talking with the Aging Network, everybody welcomes it. And his office, quite frankly, has been very, very supportive in the work that we all do in identifying this. So I welcome it, and I'm glad it is going to occur. And the only thing I would advise is put a time frame on it with a substantial report and what can be done to improve the current situation here in Wisconsin.
Now, one thing the task force is doing is it's doing a lot of interagency and in different groups, bringing different voices in so there's more communication across different entities in Wisconsin. There's justice and law enforcement and people like yourself who are working on that front. Is that important to keep people communicating about this?
Yes, because unfortunately they live in silos. And we actually formed a coalition about 3 years ago on identity fraud. And we had everyone from the post office to the Federal Trade Commission to begin to launch and do an education. And we set up a separate website. Now, that's just identity fraud. But on financial elder abuse, it's much more complicated. And it's difficult, again, for when you have 60% of the people committing crimes are family members and they don't want to report it, you have to have other coordination. So besides the interrelationship among agencies, both local, state, and federal, it's important that the nonprofit groups that are out there are doing the very same thing.
And, you know, as we wrap up here, we've been talking and hearing stories about elder abuse, financial and otherwise, here in Wisconsin and beyond. If someone is experiencing elder abuse themselves, or maybe they suspect that someone in their life that they care about is going through this, what can they do? Where do they go?
Yeah, I would tell them to call our 800 number at 488-2596. Ask for Attorney John Hendrick, who's been managing this program since 2003. He's done a brilliant job. We have staff on hand. We can advise people over the phone, in person. And we've actually, since it is a federal Department of Justice grant, we've asked for more leeway going into the next fiscal year that allows us to do a little more legal work into this field, not to take business away from others, but primarily it's very complicated that when you suspect there's elder abuse, there's an investigation period. And if we can get more engaged in that, we can do a lot of the work up front, which will expedite the situation. And I always encourage not just other family members who may be at odds, but neighbors and friends. If you suspect, if someone comes to you and says, oh, they're doing this, but please don't tell anyone, you can call us. Your identity is protected, and we will not interfere unless we think there's really cause. And then we approach it in such a way that in 9 out of 10 cases, they welcome it. It's like they feel relief, and you can just hear it in their voice. Mm. So, you know, the hardest part of this job, and I've been at it for 7 years, and the hardest part for John, who's been at it another 10 years, how can people look at themselves in the mirror when they get up in the morning and they do this stuff? It's just amazing. And let me just add one thing, too. Any insurance agent sells you an annuity for 30 years and you're 80 years old, there's a con game going on. And we've had situations where we have trained tellers in banks, a lot of the major banks and a lot of the community banks, where just a number of years ago, two young, very good salespeople selling insurance targeted this 86-year-old woman. Found out she had $300,000 in a money market, convinced her to buy an annuity, not for her grandkids or her kids, but for herself, so they can get the upfront commission. Mm-hmm. But we had trained the bank where the money was. And so there was a law that was passed a number of years ago that allowed them at least 24 hours to contact the guardian or a designated person. And we were able to jump in, protect the bank's deposit, protect her money, and unfortunately it was unethical, but it wasn't illegal. And we want to do something about cutting that off early.
Great. Well, Nino, thank you so much for coming in and talking today.
Thank you.
That was Nino Amato, president and CEO of the Coalition for Wisconsin Aging Groups. He joined us to talk about elder abuse in the state. Attorney General Brad Schimmel launched a task force last week to combat the abuse that senior citizens can face.
First, the air is getting crisp. The leaves are starting to change. Even though it's only September, fall is just a couple weeks away, and the cooler weather brings one of the best crops of the year.
On this week's Food Friday, we're talking about apples. Apples can be baked, they can be roasted, stewed, and a whole lot more. And our guest says they can shine in both sweet and savory recipes.
Amy Traverso joins us now. She's the food editor for Yankee Magazine and the author of The Apple Lover's Cookbook. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, now you wrote the cookbook. You got to be an apple lover yourself. What do you like about apples?
I love apples, and I thought I might get tired of them over the course of working on the book, and it's been several years, and I have not gotten the least bit tired of them. I love how incredibly diverse they are. They, you know, I think for most people who go to a supermarket, you see that they sell lemons, you see they sell oranges, you see they sell strawberries, and then you see they sell Red Delicious, Granny Smith, you know, Pink Lady. I think anybody who goes to a supermarket realizes that apples are varietal. In fact, all fruits are, but we're sort of more aware of apples, and each of them is so different. I mean, a Granny Smith tastes completely different from a Pink Lady, and they perform differently when you cook. So some of them hold up really well under heat. Some of them turn to applesauce really quickly. So I saw this opportunity to kind of help people figure out, all right, I'm at the farmer's market or I'm at the supermarket. What do I do with them? You know, what goes best in a pie, and what do they taste like? And then when I got into the history of apples, how they came to this country, how they were so essential to early life here, it just became an obsession.
Right. Well, can you tell us about some of that early history of the apple in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me before I started this working on the book, you know, where do apples come from? I would have said, well, I assume there are some that are native to North America, and then the pilgrims came and they started, like, you know, growing them and maybe breeding them. In fact, apples are native to Central Asia. They're native to a mountainous region kind of between China and Kazakhstan called the Tian Shan Mountain Range. And there are these wild fruit forests. So if you can imagine like the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, instead of being covered with maybe aspens, they're covered with wild apple trees, wild peach, wild, you know, apricots. It's incredible. It's really the birthplace of a lot of the fruits that we know. And trade routes would go through these hills from Asia to Persia and Greece and Rome later. And travelers would pick them up. They were sweet. They were portable. And that's how the apple made its way. And then the apple kind of thrives. It's a very genetically diverse fruit. So it has genes that allow it to thrive in a lot of different climates where, you know, you put it here, it'll figure out how to survive. So it did well in the Mediterranean. It did well in England, and ultimately was brought over, you know, by the earliest Americans and planted here. And they figured out which ones did well here, and then started breeding them like crazy.
Well, I think in the United States, if you think of the word fruit, an apple is probably the thing that pops into your head. And of course, American is apple pie. Why is the apple such an American fruit, given that it, came from elsewhere?
It's not native. Yeah, I think it's because it was such an essential ingredient in early American life. I mean, it was one of the few sources, if you can imagine, before sugar became widely available, it was one of the few sources of sweetness that you could plant and then harvest and store. I mean, there are apples that I can, even in my home refrigerator in the vegetable drawer, I can keep some apples going through February, you know, if I store them well. So, and then on top of that, from apples, you could make cider, which was the primary alcoholic beverage, but not just alcoholic. In many places, cider was safer to drink than water. So children drank it, you know, John Adams drank it every morning for breakfast. And then from cider, you could make whiskey. You could kind of concentrate the cider and make a more alcoholic product, which was an early form of anesthesia. You could make vinegar, and suddenly you had something to preserve the rest of your harvest. So it had so many uses and just really became intricately woven with early American life. And on top of that, when people were moving westward, the government, one way you could take title to a piece of land was if you planted an orchard. You had to kind of show that you were going to stick around for the government to give you the rights to the land. So apple orchards became an essential way to establish the Ohio River Valley and that whole area. Johnny Appleseed was a real guy. I mean, he was out there, you know, planting apple orchards. He's not a fictional character. And so for all these reasons, it just became part of America.
And here in Wisconsin, we're just sort of at the very beginning tendrils of apple season. It keeps going and gets better. But what do you think we can do at the very beginning of apple season?
So at the beginning of the season, you're seeing you see Jersey Mac's, Macintosh apples. A lot of these apples, you see Golden Delicious, Ginger Gold. A lot of the apples that you see at the very beginning of the summer tend to be more tender apples. It's interesting. When I say tender, what I mean is they tend to cook down more quickly. They're not apples that I would necessarily want to use in a pie, but that would make delicious applesauce, or if you were making pancakes, it doesn't matter, you know, because they're only cooking for 5 or 10 minutes. An exception, though, actually, a Golden Delicious apple, when it's fresh and firm, it will actually hold up quite well in a pie. It's this fall, it seems to be we've had some cooler weather all across the northern part of the country. Fall is sort of happening earlier this year. So some of the mid-season apples that many of us know and love, Cortland's and Pink Lady and Honeycrisp, those are all going to be, it's not going to be long before they're ripe. I mean, I imagine some orchards probably already have them, and they'll be coming in droves. Another apple I love that you'll probably be seeing in your local orchards pretty soon is the Jonathan apple. I feel like it's sort of underrated. It sort of performs and tastes a lot like the Honeycrisp, but it tends to be a little bit less expensive, and it really makes a delicious pie, along with like the Northern Spy. And I was actually doing a little bit of research on apples that were bred in Wisconsin, and it seems like some of them are making a comeback. These are apples that date back to the 1800s. So if you go to your local orchard, there are three that I found that I'm intrigued by. One is called Old Church. The other one is called, I think it's Hanko, H-A-N-K-O. This one dates back to Sauk County in 1862. And then there's a Milwaukee apple, which was came to market in 1899, kind of disappeared, but it was grown in a few places, and now a bunch of growers are trying to bring it back.
We're talking to Amy Traverso on this Food Friday. She's the author of the Apple Lovers Cookbook. We are talking about cooking with apples. And Amy, we can get more into pie and crisp and the classics like that. You also work with apples in a lot of savory things. Talk about using apple in non-dessert items.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's a little bit of a mental barrier to cooking savory dishes with apples, but if you think about apples really as being as existing on a spectrum of sweetness to tartness, you know, Granny Smith is not especially sweet; it's quite tart, and you could use that in the similar preparation that you would say citrus. You know, I think we're all used to cooking with lemon. Say, there are apples that are just as almost as tart as lemons, not quite. They all have some sugar, but so I like to think of dishes, savory dishes. I think, well, if it's a really rich thing like a braised dish, braised pork, I might want a nice kind of sweet tart apple. A sweetness really, pork plays really well with sweet flavors, but a little bit of acidity would kind of cut through the richness of the sauce. So instead of thinking apples, apple pie, dessert, I think, okay, well, what is an apple? What is the flavor of the apple? It's a certain amount of sweetness, a certain amount of acidity. There might be some other like spicy flavors or berry notes, depending on what variety. And then you can start, you know, cooking. I mean, really, any apple is going to be pretty good in a recipe, but I have recipes for an apple risotto, which is actually fantastic. It's like a white wine risotto that you you add a little bit of apple just for a hint of sweetness, but a tart one so it's not too sweet, and some grated lemon zest and Parmesan. It goes really well. Even something as simple as a grilled cheese sandwich with really good sharp cheddar and some mustard and apple slices is so great. And the apples just kind of cut through the richness of the cheese and just give you this full spectrum of flavors. And then you can do something, one of my favorite recipes is a pork and apple pie, which kind of has its roots in English pub food. I have a recipe that I just love, you know, where there's like a layer of sort of a pork, ground pork with some spices and a layer of apples all wrapped up in a cheddar and sage crust. It's just fantastic for brunch or for dinner. And then you can even, if you could just do salad, you know, just throw some apple slices into your salad with a little bit of feta or something, some walnuts or blue cheese, and you've got an amazing meal.
And let's talk about something that's a little more what we think of, not quite the apple pie, but apple crisp, which I have to be probably the number two most made apple desserts.
Number one in my house.
Number one in your house. Yeah, I love apple crisp. And it's a little easier to make than apple pie, especially if you're not cheating and buying store-bought pie crust. But tell us about, you know, apple crisp. What's your recipe for that one?
So I have two recipes. I grew up with an apple crisp that my grandmother made. She found it in a 1945 issue of Country Gentleman magazine, and I actually still have the original clipping that she took. And this one I love because it's very different from the usual kind of oat and brown sugar topping, which I also love, and I have that recipe too. This one has a topping. You might say it looks more like a cobbler. The texture is somewhere between like a cookie and a cake. It's nice and crunchy on top and very moist. And this is kind of my signature fall dessert. I always make it when company comes over because it always gets incredible raves. I just love this recipe so much. And it's very simple. It's just flour, baking powder, salt, sugar, and two eggs. And that's it for the topping. There's no milk, no liquid. And then you just drizzle some melted butter over the top and sprinkle it with cinnamon. And then, you know, for an oatmeal top dessert, I love like a really good hearty, like flour and oat and brown sugar, cinnamon, nutmeg, you know, all those good things, and maybe add some pecans if you like nuts. I mean, it's just such a perfect combination. It's the ultimate comfort food for many of us. It's something many of us grew up with as children, so it takes us back. And I think a lot of people who grow up with apples, they do kind of have that, I guess you could say, like a Proustian kind of memory component. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, it was fun when I wrote this book to go to book signings and talk to people and realize there are other people who had this kind of kooky emotional attachment to the fruit that I did. I thought I was alone, but I'm definitely not.
And by the way, we've got that recipe for Grandma Mary's apple crisp up right now on the Central Time Facebook page as we talk with Amy Traverso. She's the food editor for Yankee Magazine and the author of the Apple Lovers Cookbook with us here to talk about apples on this Food Friday.
Are you an apple lover? Join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to bake or cook with apples? Do you use apples apples in savory dishes? Do you have a secret to the perfect apple pie or crisp or cobbler or you name it? And you have questions about cooking with apples? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're continuing our conversation about how to cook with apples with Amy Traverso. She's the food editor for Yankee Magazine and the author of the Apple Lovers Cookbook.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite type of apple for cooking or baking or just eating? What are your favorite ways to cook or bake with apples? Do you like sweet apples or tart ones? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also comment and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Amy, you've got a recipe you shared with us called overnight apple butter. Tell us about what that is and what apple butter itself is. I've seen it a lot in stores, but I've never tried it or made it myself.
I love this recipe. So apple butter is basically applesauce that is reduced and caramelized over time. So it's slow-cooked applesauce that just gets this wonderful caramel flavor as the sugars actually caramelize. And it gets much thicker. And really, it's one of those recipes where you can really cook it as long as you're on low heat. You can cook it as long as you want. I mean, people like specific instructions, but really the instruction here is cook until it reaches the texture you like, because it'll just continue to thicken and evaporate. But this is a recipe that I like to make in my slow cooker, and I put everything in at night. I let it come to a boil and then turn the heat down low, leave the top ajar, and go to bed. And when I wake up in the morning, the house smells like heaven. I like to say this is my secret real estate magic recipe, because if your house isn't selling and you're having an open house, make this apple butter the night before and your house will sell. It'll just smell so incredible. And it's just this wonderful treat to wake up to in the morning. It's really easy. I mean, you literally throw everything in there and walk away.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, but they said they have a favorite Southern dish, fried apples and onions. And he said you cook it in butter. If you do it right, the onions get really sweet along with the apples. Yes. You've heard of this, Amy.
I've had fried apples. I actually haven't had them with onion. But see, there's that inspired sweet savory pairing. I mean, they go so well together. Think of caramelized onion and think of that playing with the sweet, caramelized apple. It just gives you that rounded, full spectrum of flavors. And, apples with any kind of an onion, chives, in savory dishes, it's such a good pairing. Shallots, really, really good.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Anne joining us right now in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. I love any kind of really tart apple in the fall. Half it. And put half of it on a baked pork chop and just bake a bunch of pork chops together. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Apples
and pork are perfect. They're just perfect together. They were really made for each other. There are so many things. I mean, you can bake the apples with the pork chops. It's really great. And then you get this wonderful pan sauce, and you could stir in a little bit of cream and mustard maybe to finish it off. Or you can just serve it as it is because it's really delicious. You can slice the apples and saute them and build a sauce from that, maybe a little bit of onion and maybe some creme fraiche or sour cream, and pour that over your pork chops. There's so many things, so many ways they just pair beautifully. I also have a recipe for a stuffed pork loin with sort of an apple stuffing. It's fantastic.
And thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Mary in Lebanon. Mary, hi.
Hi. I have a recipe. It's called Mrs. Huntley's Apple Cobbler, and it was my uncle's mother, and it's well over 100 years old. That I know. It's probably more than 150.
Wow. The recipe, not the cobbler itself, is that old.
Yeah, the recipe, right. So I do like to make that, and then I think of my Uncle Roy and Aunt Mildred. So
there's that memory associate. Mary, thank you so much. Amy, so many people, you say, have that family memory of an apple recipe.
And I love hearing those stories. It just warms my heart, you know. And I know that when Mary makes that, when she makes that dish, you know, it brings back all these memories. It feels like fall has begun. I actually yesterday baked my first apple dish of the season. I'm always a little reluctant to let go of summer, but I made a dish called a sweet apple pie. It's a little bit like a cobbler. It's a crustless pie that you has sort of almost like a cobbler base, and the apples are suspended in it. And even though I'm kind of gripping on to the last days of summer, you know, with all my strength, having that pie was actually a really nice way to transition into fall.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mary. And let's take another here. Jackie is joining us next in Hillsborough. Jackie, hello.
Hello. I love apples. We have a Wolf River apple tree in our yard. And if you're familiar with those apples, they can be as big as a man's hand. Mm. So it takes about 3 apples to make 1 pie, which is awesome.
Wow.
I'm not nice. Even kidding. They're amazing. And growing up, my mom would make a lot of applesauce. And what she did to flavor it differently and to thicken it was she would put Jell-O in there. Hmm. So when I make my applesauce, I fill a crock pot full of apples and dump in maybe like a half a bag of cranberries and then a box or 2 of cranberry Jell-O. So that when you grind it all up, it tastes like cranberry applesauce, and it is delicious. So you can do
that
any flavor.
Incredible.
Interesting, Jackie. So adding Jell-O to the mix, also some cranberries. What do you think about mixing it up with those 2 ingredients, Amy?
I think that's terrific. I have never done that, and I really want to try it now. I think it would give it a really silky mouthfeel, like a really lovely kind of creamy texture, which I bet is really delicious. And the Wolf River apple is native to Wisconsin, so that's and it is a fantastic pie apple. And yeah, I would be totally game to try that. One thing I also like to do with apple pies, in terms of like sauces, is I grew up actually with a grandmother, my other grandmother, who made her pies with Macintosh apples. She loved the flavor of Macintosh, but what you would get was, and the pies were delicious, but they were very mushy because they just don't hold up to 45 minutes of cooking. But what I do, but the flavor is, you know, Macintosh are delicious apples. So what I like to do now is maybe combine, you know, if I'm going to cook with, make a pie with, say, 10 standard apples, I might do 4 that are max and 5 and 6 that are, you know, another apple variety that are more, that hold up better, maybe a Northern Spy or something like that, Honeycrisp. And so what you get is sort of apple slices suspended in a nice sauce. So it's fun to kind of play with the textures. You don't have to go one way or the other.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Amy, as we wrap up, I got to ask, you've tried a lot of kinds of apples, obviously. Is there a holy grail, an apple you've heard of but haven't encountered in person yet that you really want to try and eat or cook with?
Oh, you know, for me right now, the holy grail is to go to Kazakhstan, which is the birthplace of apples. In fact, there's a wonderful cafe in my neighborhood, and the owner is from Kazakhstan, and she has told me stories of these forests that she grew up picking apples in. So I would love to go there, and there are so many French and Italian and British apple varieties that we don't get here. I would just love to go and spend one fall of my life doing an apple tour from, you know, the Northern Europe down south, for even Sweden. I would just love to do that. So for me, it's kind of about traveling to apple regions in the country. But what I'm so excited about, and I think I know this is true in Wisconsin as well, is more and more apple growers are pulling out rows of more familiar, maybe Red Delicious apples, and putting in these heirlooms. So we all have more and more access to hundreds of varieties of apple, and that's really exciting.
We'll leave it there. Amy, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with your apple tourism plans.
Thank you.
That's Amy Traverso, food editor for Yankee Magazine, author of The Apple Lover's Cookbook. She joined us to talk about some of her favorite ways to cook and bake with apples. Are you going to get out apple picking this year?
I hope so. I don't think we made it last year.
No,
we definitely
neither.
Ate a lot of apples,
right.
Bought a lot of interesting varieties of apples, but the picking, not so much.
Yeah, I got to get out to an orchard. You can still share your favorites and check out more over at the Central Time Facebook page. The world is celebrating Star Trek Day today, at least the part of the world that likes Star Trek.
The day marks the debut of the original Star Trek series on this day in 1966.
And as we've mentioned before, I don't think anybody had any idea that people would still be talking about Star Trek 50 plus now years later.
I know, and there are still spin-offs from the original series, or at least there's a new TV show inspired by the old Star Trek.
And of course, the reboot of the movies.
The reboot of the movies, which is really good. I really like these movies.
I like those too, actually. Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised, I gotta say. And my kids have watched, actually they've watched some of the series that I haven't watched. I didn't do Voyager.
Oh,
I think
Voyager's
they went through all of
really
that.
Good.
That's my kids say.
Yeah, Captain Janeway.
Right. Yeah.
The first, I think, only female captain in this franchise, right?
I believe so.
I do like her. I like Picard a lot.
Well, I like Commander Sisko.
And I went through a phase. I'm going to be honest. I didn't like Captain Kirk for a long time, but now I've circled back, and now I like him again.
Okay. Retro.
Yeah.
Old school.
Yeah. And he's out there. He's on Twitter making a splash, and as is George Takei. I love these guys.
All right. Well, I didn't get you a Star Trek Day present again this year. I'm sorry about that.
I wasn't going to say anything. I'm a little hurt.
Enjoy your Star Trek memories. This is Central Time.